Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 24th of June. The author of Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business. Or as somebody once said, it's very expensive to be poor in this country. Our guest is Gary Rivlin. He is the award-winning author of three books of nonfiction, Fire on the Prairie, Chicago's Harold Washington, and The Politics of Race, Drive-By, and The Plot to Get Bill Gates, an irreverent investigation of the world's richest man and the people who hate him. He has won a number of awards for distinguished business reporting and has worked as a writer and reporter for The New York Times, Industry Standard, East Bay Express, and the Chicago Reader. His articles have appeared in publications all over the country. This is a very compelling story, and he tells it through the eyes of some compelling people, some who are really trying to correct evil and others who are pretty shady characters who are driven by a love of money and probably very little moral sense about them. It's the first in-depth look at this industry that I've read in a long time. We'll be welcoming phone calls for our guest, and our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hello, Gary.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Yeah, thanks very much for being with us. You write later in the book that you can remember the exact moment when your view started to harden in opposition to the payday loan. You were on an airplane, and what were you thinking?
So I entered this project a couple of years ago thinking, like, you know, maybe the payday loan makes sense. Not everyone has a rich uncle. Not everyone has access to a credit card. A payday loan, of course, is a quick cash advance against your next paycheck. And I thought, what do you do if you don't have $300 to fix your car and you need it to get to and from work? And, you know, I had this stack of printouts I brought. I spent a lot of time in Ohio just to place the story somewhere. So you saw the way all these various poverty industries were appearing and the impact on a community. And so I had this Attorney General's report, and they had done it for Ohio, and they had done held hearings. And they had ex-payday lending employees testify. They had customers testifying. And it just really gave me a really different perspective that this wasn't they were sitting there waiting for people to come in looking for an emergency loan. They were pushing this really hard. They were creating the demand. They were using some methods that I thought really crossed a line, at least for me personally. And maybe the biggest point is you read the academic studies. These are two-week loans. You read the academic studies, you hear from the consumer advocates who study this stuff, and the average person has 12 or 13 of these a year. That's half the year they're owing these short-term cash advances that have interest rates, if you express it that way, of 400% a year, 500% a year.
Unbelievable.
In fact, Wisconsin, maybe you can help me. I know you all have been struggling with, you know, can we cap the payday lenders? Can we rein them in? But, you know, last I checked, Wisconsin had no cap. The sky was the limit.
The industry in Wisconsin has been regulated for the first time, but it was passed in April. So loans will be limited to $1,500 or 35% of the applicant's monthly income.
Right.
You can roll the loans over only once, and payday loan stores can't be located within 1,500 feet of one another or 150 feet
and then
of residential areas.
You laugh at that, but there's a brilliance to that because, you know, I have a chapter about a single woman who ran one of these payday shops. She was a store manager for 10-plus years. And she would sit in her store and watch a kind of human pinball. She had the biggest parking lot, so someone would come to her store and borrow the money or pay off money, and then she would watch as they would walk across the street to the store, and they would pay them back or borrow money from them, and then they'd go to a third store, which happened to be Catty Corner, and then they would finish up their little escapade and visit a fourth store and then come back and take their car and leave. And that's so much of the problem. You have people owing multiple stores at once. And, you know, these are people who are living on the margins. They're so yes. desperate for cash, they're paying this huge, exorbitant fee for their money. They're making $25,000, $30,000, $35,000 a year. Once you owe two or three stores, $300 here, $500 there, it's really hard to get out of.
Yeah. And you tell the stories of some of these people, it just makes you so mad that there's no sense, this sense of examining your own soul to think, am I doing the right thing by this person who may be 85 years old and living in a house that she can't afford a new roof, but we're going to sell her a new roof? And then really take advantage of her, that they package these things together, the roof, and then you get the mortgage as well. A lot of shady practices that don't look at the human beings on the other side at all.
So now we're on to subprime yeah. mortgage lending. And, you know, I feel if anyone wants to debate the behavior of all those people who use their homes as an ATM to take out a home equity loan to build a second bathroom, go to Europe. They, you know, they bought a $600,000 house even though they had a salary good enough for half that. Sure, we can debate the morality of that, but what I found is a very different side to the subprime mortgage story. Starting in the 1980s, when the federal government deregulated home lending in this country, you start to have small-time lenders working the inner cities, rural areas that had fallen on hard times, you know, working class enclaves, wherever they could find it, selling these loans that with interest rates of 20% a year, 25% a year, with huge upfront costs, 10% upfront costs, 15, 20%. The typical home buyer who has a conventional rate mortgage is paying maybe 1% in closing costs. These people were paying 10, 20 times that. And, you know, it was literally as if out of the movie The Tin Man, home repairmen knocking on the doors of little old ladies, driving them to the mortgage broker that, of course, they had the relationship with. They'd put them into these onerous mortgages and then just pack them. That's the term that the industry uses. We're just packing the loans. You sell them credit life insurance. If you're an 80-year-old woman living on a fixed income and living by yourself, you don't need credit life insurance.
Right.
Once you pass away, your home would be sold. It would go to your heirs. This is meant for, you know, somebody who's you've got a working couple and they couldn't afford the loan if one person died. And yet these are really expensive products that they were just selling to unsophisticated buyers. So there's a real predatory side, and then it turned into big companies, big brand name banks. We could start naming names, but you know they were inspired by all the profits being made by these smaller, shadier lenders. So Household Finance, Fleet Finance, was the biggest bank in New England. They started going through tax records to see, okay, who owns a lot of equity in their home, who perhaps owes back taxes. Then they compare them to credit. Records that show who owed a lot in credit card bills. And so they would start cold calling these people in working class communities that they knew owned a lot in their home but somehow were in financial difficulty, owed some money to credit card companies, owed back taxes, and they would just sell them these predatory loans. Again, these are predatory loans. We're not talking about middle class buying too much home than they can afford. And, you know, it was just the aggressiveness with which it was going on and the profits. I mean, Household Finance in the early 2000s was making $2 billion a year in profits.
Goodness gracious.
$2 billion in profits.
Isn't that amazing? Wow. Let's go back to payday loans here for just a moment. The people in the areas, and I think you went to some conventions of these people, which yeah. I'd like for you to talk about in a moment, would say that, well, we're performing a valuable service. The banks have left these areas and people need money and we're allowing them to get their car fixed so they can go to work, or we're getting them money so that they can take care of an illness, and nobody else is going to do this.
Well, so I went to the annual check cashers convention in Las Vegas, of all places. It was their 20th anniversary. And one thing that's interesting is they no longer call themselves check cashers, the financial service centers. Please show the proper respect. But it's not just the check cashers or the financial service center operators who show up. It's the payday lenders. It's people in rent to own. It's debt collectors. It's the people behind this really odd business, the instant tax refund. They all show up at the check cashers, meaning to trade tips for maximizing revenues and, you know, how to fight regulators and such. I attended some of these sessions, which were really eye-opening for me. But the most interesting thing, I think, was to hear the way they spoke about themselves. I thought that maybe I'd get a defensiveness or like, hey, it's perfectly legal what we do. We have every right to operate these businesses. But instead, they cast what they were doing as noble. We're the intrepid entrepreneurs who are venturing into communities where it is true the banks have fled if they ever were in some of these communities. And, you know, the check cashier is providing a service. I mean, there's 17 million or so people in this country who have no checking account, the unbanked, they're called. And, you know, you can outlaw check cashiers tomorrow, and what would happen to all those people who get paychecks but have messed up their relationship with a bank, or they don't trust banks for whatever reason, they don't have a checking account. You know, so that suddenly liquor stores and grocery stores would cash checks, and of course they would charge something because there's a little bit of risk in sure. bouncing checks. The problem with the check cashers, and Wisconsin is a perfect example of this, is that the fees depends on where you sit. I'm sitting in New York City right now, and the check cashers can charge about 1.8% of the face value of a check, a payroll check or a government check. And, okay, so you make $20,000 a year. That's a works out to like a $400 fee over the course of the year. You live in Georgia, you live in Arkansas, they could charge 5%
wow.
of the face value wait, of a paycheck or a government check. And, you know, I mean, a payroll check is a pretty safe bet. A government check
yes.
is a very safe bet. There is a one-third of the states, including the lovely state of Wisconsin. I lived a lot of years in Chicago, so I've been to your great state a number of times. There's no limit. One-third of the states in this country have no limit on the amount you can charge to cash a person's check. So I happened to meet at that check cashers convention Tim Thomas of Daddy's Money Pawn, and on the side, to make extra money, he cashes checks. And he's explaining to me why he charges 10% for any handwritten check. And I think, okay, well, that must be a risky check. It's handwritten. But it turns out that he has his employee. You wait. You bring in this check. You sit there and you wait, or you have to come back until they call you, because they call the bank to make sure the money's in there. They call the person who wrote the check to make sure that, in fact, they wrote the check. And then the person gets their money. So I asked Mr. Thomas,
oh my.
Well, why do you charge 10%? He just kind of shrugs and said, because I can.
Oh, my. Because I can.
And think about this. I mean, 10%, that's a huge chunk of your money right there.
Well, and immediately you say, that shouldn't be legal. How can anybody do that?
Well, you know, I mean, if I was czar of the country, I mean, one of the things I would say is, like, you know, we should have federal regulation of check cashers. There's at least one rule that, let's say there's a cap of 2%, 3%. I mean, the check cashers in New York State are making a nice living. Cap it with a cap on their fee of less than 2%. I mean, they sell debit cards and make a lot of money. There are a bunch of fees involved in that. They make money in bill paying. You don't have a checking account. Not only do you need a place to cash your check, you need a way to pay your utility bill. You need a way to pay your landlord. So they're making typically $2 here, $2 there for bill paying. So there's a myriad of ways they're making money. And, okay, so if the check cashers in New York are able to make a nice profit, why are we allowing 5% rates, or, again, in one-third of the states, no cap?
Right. Yeah, that's really something. So it points to the lobbying power, and I know that's been true in the state of Wisconsin for a long time, that the industry fought hard for years against regulation, spending, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on lobbying.
Well, I think one thing that has to be made clear about the payday lenders is the way the industry it's a new industry. It's not 20 years old, and believe it or not, there are as many payday stores in the U.S. as there are McDonald's and Burger King.
Unbelievable.
Combined. And they only operate in about two-thirds of the state, because what they had to do, and this is millions and millions and millions of dollars they spent on campaign contributions and lobbyists in states around the country. In most states have a usury cap, a cap on the interest rate you can charge on a loan. So they had to get exemptions from existing usury caps to be able to offer these loans. Their logic was, well, it's a fee on a two-week loan. These are loans typically of 300, 500. It doesn't, an APR, an annual percentage rate, doesn't really apply. So they were granted this exemption by dozens of states around the country, but we're starting to see states, Ohio recently, and New Hampshire, Oregon, North Carolina, a few others, who have there's been a bounce back. They've taken away the exemption in Ohio. They've outlawed payday lending in a couple of other states. So the payday lenders talk about, hey, don't regulate us, don't overregulate us. I just want to point out that they were granted a key exemption from a pretty fundamental law that dates back to before we were a country. I mean, this dates back, usury laws date back to England and you know, just right. For centuries we've had usury laws in this world.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls for you. Our guest this hour is Gary Rivlin. His book, very engrossing, Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Lines are open for you right now. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gary Rivlin is our guest. The book is Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, How the Working Poor Became Big Business. Instant tax refunds, rent to own, payday loans, used car financing, consumer finance loans, a huge business, the poverty industry, as Gary calls it, that has grown so large that it has generated far more revenues than even the country's casinos. He looks at people who are involved in this and people who have been taken by this in his very well-documented book. There are different aspects of this. Let's look for just a moment at this rent-to-own, which is another particularly egregious kind of business, because you may want to get a television, and we live in a society where people want to buy things. It's not like a depression time where you save to buy what it was that you needed. Part of it is, I think, our culture. But also, you can get this television, which people need to have these days, and you can't afford it. And so you rent it, and then you wind up paying how much more for the television? It's just unbelievable.
No, I mean, there's a certain brilliance. I mean, I was a business reporter for the New York Times for a number of years, and there is a part of me, I must confess, that almost admires the, maybe it's a diabolical brilliance, that people came up with these businesses, and rent-to-own is one of them, that they have figured out a way to selling a $500 TV for $1,200. And so, I mean, even the way they price it, Rent-A-Center is the biggest of the rent-to-own companies, and in case anybody thinks this is a small business, Rent-A-Center is publicly traded, had $3 billion in revenues last year and a couple hundred million in profits. This is real Wall Street business. All these businesses are Wall Street businesses that have been financed by the biggest banks in the country. But, you know, stick with rent-to-own. So Rent-A-Center, they price at four times their cost. So if they could buy a TV for $300, when they're thinking about how much they're going to make from it, they just multiply by four. And you look at Best Buy and the profit margin they have, and you look at Rent-A-Center or Aaron's, the other biggie, and look at the profit margin they have, they're making more money off their customers than a Best Buy is. Now, they point out that, well, we deliver for free, and, you know, Best Buy, you walk out the door, they're done with you. You know, at Rent-A-Center, you're paying typically by the week for the item. You pay for typically 78 weeks, and at the end of the 78 weeks, you own the TV, the couch, the washer-dryer. And, you know, they'll point out that if anything goes wrong, we'll come and fix it, we'll replace it, we'll give you a loaner until it is fixed. They are providing more service than your average retailer, but on the other hand, it is a very expensive way to buy any kind of item. Clearly, we don't have. I agreed with how you prefaced this. We've lost a sense of thrift in this country that, you know, if you could just save up for 6 months to buy the new flat screen TV, you could get it at, you know, less than half the price. But that's not our country. We're an instant gratification country. There are these very convenient ways to get a TV. By the way, of course, what they're pushing the hardest are the 42 or 50 whatever inch flat screen TVs.
Right.
I mean, we're not talking about the modest, the more modest TVs. We're talking about, you know, what they're advertising. What if you go to their website right now? I guarantee that they'll be playing up, you know, some large, expensive flat screen TV right now.
Yeah, and they're always, at least to what I've seen, they're always located in very poor neighborhoods.
Well, you know, there's almost like a geography of poverty. And I think most of us, or maybe speaking for myself, until I really took on this project, I was blind to it. You know, if you see a Pottery Barn next to a Barnes & Noble, next to the Restoration store, you know you're in a prosperous, you know, middle-class community. Well, there are similar signifiers that tell you you're in a working-class community nowadays. And you know, it doesn't make a difference. I mean, black, white, rural, suburban, urban, it doesn't make a difference anymore. These businesses are everywhere. The payday lenders, the rent-to-own, the instant tax mills, they're in the working-class white communities of our cities. They're in the African-American communities. They're in the first-ring suburbs. They're in the exurbs. They're in the rural areas that have fallen on hard times. And, you know, wherever I would go, you know, once I knew the names, I knew the brands, you know, there would be the Rent-A-Center around the corner from the Jackson Hewitt tax prep place, next to the check cashier, across the street from the Ace check cashing chain, the largest of the check cashing chains. And, you know, it's again, hanging out with the, you know, what's called the pioneers of subprime, you know, those who were in this business and, in fact, created a lot of these businesses, you know, they'll point out, like, hey, we're paying rents in communities where there would otherwise be empty storefronts. We're employing people in communities where unemployment is a huge problem. We're contributing tax dollars to the local tax base. So, you know, some of the fun or some of the interesting part for me personally in this project was like, okay, are they these financial angels that they make themselves out to be, or are they these vultures that the consumer critics make them out to be, or where in between those two poles is the truth?
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about some of those characters in a moment. Let's get to phone calls. Brooks in Milwaukee. Hi, Brooks. Brooks, are you there? Well, call back. Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Oh, Brooks.
Brooks is not there. Jim, you are. Jim, are you there? I don't know what's going on.
It was getting tongue-tied in Wisconsin, huh?
I don't know what the story is. Here's an email that's come in. Isn't this culture the result of self-inflicted bad trade policies that sent our good jobs overseas?
You know, I would say before I got to that on my list, I would say that we don't have a culture of thrift. But beyond that, you know, I look at stagnating wages. For the last 10 or 20 years, real wages of those in the bottom 40% have not kept pace with inflation, while at the same time, rents and health care, fuel costs have exceeded the rate of inflation. So the person who's got two kids, who's trying to make ends meet on $20,000, $30,000 a year, how are they ever going to save money? And that's what these businesses play on. I joked that I was writing about this upside-down world in which people with no money in their pockets was good for business, because people with no money in their pockets wants to go to the pawnbroker. They want to go to the payday lender or the auto title loan shop. If you have no money in your pocket, that's why you're going to the rent-to-own shop. So, you know, I would say kind of, you know, the broader economics in this country and our appetite for credit in the U.S. and are desiring things instantly and not having this culture of thrift. Those, I would say, are more of what's been feeding the growth of these businesses.
Jim is with us now, I think. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I'm a former retail banking manager here in Milwaukee, and I was one of those neighborhood bankers who opposed the check cashing services when they first came to town. And you know, my company basically made the decision, and it was a major bank in the city, that we're going to support them because it's much cheaper for us to work with them than to provide basic services to the poor. And we simply decided it was better for us economically. And that's when we went from opposing check cashing to supporting check cashing. And it's never worked out for any community that, you know, really can't, nobody wants this kind of alternative. But the bank simply shut down the only alternative people have. We said, we don't do it anymore.
I mean, Jim is making a really essential point. It is not just Milwaukee, of course. The same thing happened. It's almost like a symbiotic relationship between the banks and some of these fringe financers. I mean, they don't want these customers. I mean, customers making $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 a year, if you're living on the margins, you know, it's going to be very difficult. You're not generating much revenue for a bank, and yet you have a lot of costs. And the FDIC, the federal regulator in Washington, has tried to pressure banks to do more to bank the unbanked, to try to bring in those customers who have no checking account. The FDIC, under Sheila Bair, has also been great about trying to get banks to offer an alternative payday product so people don't feel so desperate that they're willing to pay the 400-500% equivalent interest rate for a loan. And, you know, there's been a lot of well-meaning effort, and there's been, you know, nice, important conferences and meetings, and people are talking about it. But there's a few pilots around the country. There's a few efforts around the country. But the fact is, when the payday lenders say, hey, there are no alternative to us, they're largely correct. There's a few credit unions, there's a few nonprofits, there's a couple of banks offering an alternative product, but there isn't really much interest in the banks in going after this this particular consumer, this particular market.
Thanks, Jim. Marty in Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good morning. I think a big part of this problem as well, the proliferation of these businesses, is we don't care about the poor in this country. We haven't cared about poor people since Jimmy Carter was president. It's one of the reasons I was supporting John Edwards until he crashed and burned. John Edwards was the only politician that I can think of in the last, 25 years who was talking about poor people. We just don't care. And so these businesses have lobbyists that can talk to politicians and convince them that not regulating them is a great idea. Poor don't have lobbyists. Since the economy has tanked, and I think I heard this yesterday on the radio, that Jack Abramoff is out of jail and he's working at a pizza joint somewhere in New York City or Washington.
Is he really?
Yeah. Maybe now that people who used to have money no longer have money, or there are more of us out there who are really living on the margins, maybe now a little bit more attention will be paid to these businesses that prey on poor people.
So first, I feel like I need to give a shout out to my former employer. So the New York Times this morning has a page one story about Abramoff, and you know,
I didn't see that.
Yeah, he's gone from making a lot of dough to making a different kind of dough. Is the joke? That wasn't original. I stole that. but he is in fact working at a pizza place somewhere in the greater Washington area. But you know, I think maybe what's even The people I'm writing about, or the customers, the main customer for most of the businesses I'm writing about, are the working poor. I mean, these are the people who are doing it right. I mean, they're the warehouse workers and home health care people. These are people who are working really, really hard, doing essential jobs for our society, and yet they're being taken. You know, it's just treachery. And by the way, I wouldn't have a problem if these businesses were in our working class communities and making average size profits. What really, really troubles me is that subprime credit cards is a perfect example. Subprime credit card issuers are making two or three times the rate of profit off their customers as they're making off conventional credit card customers. And, you know, building risk, that's one thing. People with, you know, tarnished credit,
yes,
sure, they'll default more often. They'll be late, which, of course, late payments are pretty good for credit card companies. But I get why you have to have what's called risk-based pricing. But it turns out to be opportunity-based pricing. Like, huh, you know, let's build in the risk and, you know, let's double the profit margin. The same thing happened with the subprime mortgage lending. If you want to know why AmeriQuest and Countrywide and New Century and that whole list, Wells Fargo, they all got in to subprime mortgage lending, it's because they saw the profits that these smaller lenders, these more fringe lenders like a Household Finance, they were making such huge profits off their subprime mortgages that it just proved irresistible. And that, to me, is the moral issue here, is that you're making far more money off the single mom with two kids working as a waitress, you know, working as a chambermaid at the local Holiday Inn, barely getting by. You're making more money off of them than you are off, you know, the more prosperous white-collar people. That, to me,
that's just not right.
Yeah, that's just right. I try to be a journalist and give all sides, but, you know, I do come down like, I'm sorry, that is just wrong.
Yeah. And tell the story. We have to get into some stories here. There are some crusaders, people who are really looking out for consumers and poor consumers. Can you what's his first name? Brennan?
Bill Brennan.
Bill Brennan.
Yeah, so Bill Brennan, he's been a legal aid attorney in Atlanta for 40-plus years. And, you know, he'd always been something of a crusader. But in 1991, Annie Lou Collier comes into his office. She's owned the same house. She's 80 years old, African-American woman, you know, born, you know, grew up Jim Crow South, had a second-grade education, lived in the same house, owned it outright for 37 years. Her husband was deceased, living on a pension or Social Security, his pension and Social Security. And she got taken by one of these home repair guys. It sold her the roof that she couldn't afford on her fixed income, and a year later, she was facing foreclosure, and that just changed his life. For the last 19 years, he has done virtually nothing except for try to sound the warning alarm about subprime mortgage lending. And I think if I had to sum up what he was seeing in a single sentence, he saw lenders making loans to people that they couldn't possibly afford. And so early on, it was about equity stripping. Okay, this old lady owns a house worth $50,000. Let's give her a $7,000 loan. If she could pay it, great. We're making, on that one, 25.3% interest, and all those extra fees I was talking about earlier were crammed in. And if she could pay it, great. We're going to make a lot of money off this loan. If we can't, well, we'll take her house. He's testified before Congress three, four, five times. He's spoken to the Federal Reserve. He's attended well-meaning conferences at the FTC, or Andrew Cuomo is the head of HUD under Bill Clinton, held to try to say, like, folks, this is a disaster in the making. I mean, I think something people don't understand about the subprime disaster is that 80% of the loans were refinances, or their home equity loans. They were taking existing equity and hollowing it out. So you had all these people. In 1980 was when we deregulated as a country home loans. It used to be caps of typically 10%, 12% on a home mortgage rate. So there are all these people who bought a home under the old rules, where there was a cap on the mortgage, and somehow got taken financial ignorance. They were in trouble because of a health care problem, lost income, they got into credit card debt, whatever it was, and they let themselves be refinanced in one of these subprime mortgage loans, and it just took away their equity. In fact, there's a real racial aspect to race aspect to the subprime disaster. I really feel it's one of the big underreported parts of this story. HUD, again, under Cuomo, did a study that found that if you lived in an African-American neighborhood, you were five times more likely to get a subprime loan than if you lived in a predominantly white community. And then they said, well, let's control, let's hold for income So they looked at African Americans making $100,000 or more. They were still 2 times more likely to be steered into a subprime loan compared to low moderate income white. That the you had a generation of African Americans making progress on the one front in gaining home ownership. At the same time, subprime just wiped that all away. All these people, it was 7 million foreclosures we're up to right now post 2008. So many hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, African Americans had their homes foreclosed. So the equity they had built up was just wiped out.
And what was the purpose in targeting African Americans?
Well, I mean, it started off as targeting African Americans, and then they said, why don't
we can do this to everybody,
anybody. I mean, you know, equal opportunity predators here. So let's talk about the mortgage broker for a moment. I've used a mortgage broker in my life, and I thought that there's one thing and one thing only a mortgage broker does for you. You go to them, and they know all the potential loans out there, and presumably they'll put you, how they're earning their fee is, they'll put you in the one that's most advantageous for you. But I didn't know this. I learned this doing this research. There's something called a yield spread premium, which just is a fancy term for a bribe. The lenders, Ameriquest, Countrywide, a lot of them were huge into doing this. They would give an extra bonus to the mortgage brokers if they steered you into a more expensive subprime mortgage. I mean, it's thousands of dollars in extra fees for every person you'd steer into a subprime mortgage because, I'm paying 6% annual interest on their mortgage, on their refinance, on their home equity loan, they'd be paying 9%. And of course, the bank has a huge upside for these banks. And the Federal Reserve did a study, and they found that 50% of the people who got subprime mortgages had credit scores good enough for a conventional rate. Then the Wall Street Journal more recently did the same study, and they found 60% of the people they looked at who were in subprime mortgages had credit scores good enough for a conventional rate loan.
Let's go.
It is equity theft. I mean,
right.
The one way of looking at what just happened. A lot of homeowners, I'll stipulate, a lot of homeowners lost their head. They deserve some of the blame. But if you look at, on Wall Street, the big banks on Wall Street that securitize these things, the big name brand banks, JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citibank, Bank of America, they were all huge into subprime mortgage lending. And a lot of this was about equity theft.
Jerry in Onalaska, hi.
Hi. I just thought I would ask our speaker here to tell me why banks can't make money at this. I mean, here's what I'm thinking. A bank has got a building already. They got employees. They don't have to add any expense. They don't have to build these buildings all over the state, like you're saying, as many as McDonald's and Burger King put together. All those assets had to be built on the backs of these poor people. But yet banks didn't see the profit in that. Now, wait, I think we have to come back to the reasoning that what's happened is the banks are regulated so much that they can no longer make a small loan profitably. That regulation is the regulation is what is causing this. The regulation that puts a burden, and the same liberals who are crying about the poor people not being able to get loans are the ones who cause these regulations.
Well, though, I think the story of the last 30 years has been deregulation that, as I mentioned earlier, is in 1980 that we took the federal government preempted states from putting any kind of cap on the mortgage loans, and then they allowed for all these, more exotic mortgages, adjustable rate mortgages, balloon rate mortgages, which got a lot of people in trouble. There used to be a cap on the upfront fees of 1%. They removed that. I mentioned earlier that the payday lenders got exemptions from existing usury laws. So to me, the story of the subprime mortgage disaster was deregulation. And a second point, one of the main characters in the book is living proof of this, that you hear, the poor are to blame for the subprime mortgage disaster. I mean, you know, me, I would say Wall Street and a lot of Southern California banks and their greed is mainly to blame for the subprime mortgage crisis. But the poor, there are all these lenders across the country, I mean, typically nonprofits, who are singling out those of low and moderate income to make home loans to. And what you find is, well, they're putting people in homes that cost $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year, homes you could afford on a salary of $20,000, $30,000 a year, and they had remarkably low foreclosure rates. They had very low delinquency rates, even post-2008, compared to what you see the subprime mortgage lending lenders do. So there was pressure from the government, yes, to do more to help those of moderate income buy homes. But I think we have proof from hundreds of organizations that did put people into homes they could afford. The problem was that this newest crop, this last crop of subprime mortgage lenders, they didn't care if somebody couldn't afford a home because they were going to sell it the next day to Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns or Goldman Sachs, who were going to slice it, dice it, and, you know, sell it off to pension funds and governments around the world. And so I really think it's a canard that, you know, it's the poor who to blame.
Mm. Thanks for the call. We go to some emails now. My question is, if there is a check cashing store, as mentioned, that's charging 10%, why don't we just leave it up to the consumer to realize this is a bad deal and maybe they should get checks cashed elsewhere?
Yeah, no, it's true that no one is putting a gun to anyone's head to go to this payday lender or this check cashing store. And unlike the subprime mortgage, there isn't deception. I mean, a lot of what happened with subprime mortgage lending was bait and switch. Hey, we'll give you a 7.2% loan. You go to the closing, like, oh, you know, sorry, we couldn't do it. And it's a 10% loan, and people don't realize, like, how much of a difference that is in their monthly payments. There's a lot of, you know, forging of signatures. There's a lot of lawsuits about that. You know, the credit rating agencies, you know, called things AAA that were junk. So this isn't that. I mean, you go to a payday lending store, and the fees are obvious that we're going to charge whatever, $15, $17, $20 per hundred, and that works out to an annual percentage rate of 400%, whatever. Same with the check cashier. It's almost like going to a McDonald's. You see the big menu, and here's what the various services cost. The problem is that in any state where there's a cap, every single check cashier charges the cap rate. So if it's a 5% cap, no matter what store you go to, it's going to be 5%. There's an economist. I mean, because I asked the question, like, well, why isn't someone offering 4%, you know, and getting much more, you know, the Walmart way? Like, well, we'll make less profit, but we'll have such huge volume that we'll make more money. And, you know, his argument, conservative-leaning economist, is that when you put a cap in place, everybody just charges the cap rate, because the caller makes a good point. I mean, if this guy's, if daddy's money is charging 10%, why don't you go to, you know, Joe's pawn, Joe's check cashing a block away? It's because Joe's is also charging the 10%. Because why? Because he can.
Because you can, yeah. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Gary Rivlin. His book is Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business. 800-486-8655. One line is open. The email address, talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Would you tell us a couple stories, please? You start the book with how, God bless them, the Myers got taken. They had their little dream home, worked very hard, sickness in the family, wound up because of one of these shady deals in a trailer park, and then had to move again. It's such a sad story.
No, it is. In fact, I was kind of just talking about them, that, you know, they were... So let me back up. So Household Finance, huge company that started, you know, in the 19th century, and, you know, had a very good idea. Like, well, let's create the installment loan. You know, you're working class and you want to buy an icebox, I guess, then, or, you know, you want to buy a wedding ring, wedding rings to get married. Honey, what do you do? And so they came up with the installment loan. Well, it morphed into something really, really different with the deregulation in the 1980s of mortgage lending. Household finance got aggressively into mortgage lending, and so they had people. They did these shops, almost like boiler rooms, all around the country, with people working the list. They would call people. Oh, this person has $28,000 in credit card debt. The Wall Street Journal hung out in one of these things, and I'm talking about an actual story. This person has $28,000 in credit card debt, and they have equity in their home. What a perfect person to sell one of these loans, refinances, or home equity loan with a 15%, 18% interest rate. And so the Myers were getting regular calls. Once Mrs. Myers, he was a truck driver. She works at a school cafeteria. And she turns out she had congenital heart problem. She can't work for a year. They get about $10,000 in credit card debt because they don't have her salary. So suddenly household finance is calling all the time. He's thinking to himself, hey, this isn't a bad idea. I'm paying 7% on my mortgage, and they're offering me 7.2%. Well, they weren't offering 7.2%. It was effective 7.2%. It was actually a 13.9% loan, and it, too, was crammed with, you know, credit life insurance, $7,500 credit life insurance policy that they financed. And so, you know, paying 13.9% interest not on their not just their refinancing the worth of the home, but also on this credit life insurance. They got creamed by, you know, huge $7,500 in upfront costs. Two, and they end up, they can't keep up with the payments. And by the time I caught up with the Myers, they had moved out of, you know, one trailer park that had a pool to a much lesser one across the street from a metal scrap factory. And 74, thought he was going to be able to retire at 68, 70. Still working midnight to 8 a.m., three nights a week, and didn't feel sorry for himself about that. He just felt bad that he let his wife down. I mean, he felt stupid. You know, like, how was I taken? I you know, I blew it. And it really was heartbreaking because he was mad at himself, and he made a mistake. I mean, there's no doubt about it. He made a mistake, but these businesses were looking for unsophisticated people. These businesses were also defrauding people, and if you don't believe me, 46 state attorney generals settled with household finance about a year later after they put the Myers in this loan for $484 million, at that point the biggest consumer fine ever. And at first I felt like, wow, that's a huge fine. But then I did the math. There were so many tens of thousands of people who were in this class that it worked out to $1,500 a person. And, of course, they suffered a lot more than $1,500 worth of damage. And that year, household finance made $2 billion in profits. And, in fact, when the announcement went out that they were paying, in quotes, only $484 million, their stock went up by a third because investors got it. Like, well, okay, we dodged the bullet. We thought this was going to cost us more.
Let's go to John in Kenosha. Hi, John.
Hello, I've been looking for some information. Maybe you know the answer. People I'm aware of who lost houses for foreclosure were mainly investors and people who were flipping houses and beyond their means. And from that perspective, do you know the percentage of people, you know, of modest means who were simply trying to get a house versus people who are investing of the bankruptcies or foreclosures? What percentage were people who were poor people you're talking about are trying to get houses, and what percent were investors with condos, et cetera?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, some of the challenge in writing about the poverty industry that I didn't quite appreciate when I took it on is, you know, we haven't talked about used car finance. Consumer finance much. This is such a broad, I mean, debt remediation. We'll help you with your bankruptcy. We'll collect the fee, and we won't really help you. You know, got credit card debt, we'll help you. Well, no, they won't. There's all these businesses out there. What I can say, John, is I do know that the vast majority of these loans, of these subprime mortgages, were refinances. And that's not what, you know, the investors were looking for. So, yeah, some investors got burnt here. But my sense is, and I'm not 100% sure, but my sense is that the great majority of people who got stuck were you know, individuals and non-investor groups.
And thank you very much for the call. And here's an email which sums some of this up from the perspective of somebody who's struggling. This is from Elvira, who's working a 40-hour week accounting job, raises are frozen, also works part-time at a Wisconsin-based department store for 5 to 20 hours a week, sells plasma twice a week, the maximum possible, has a title loan with a large interest payment every month, and today is her last payment on a payday loan she took out 3 months ago to pay NSP, even after energy assistance, for which she paid $400 interest on a $700 loan. Used to make $50K, but lost her job in 2007.
Yeah, no, this is a perfect place to kind of wind things down. Elvira's story is typical. You talk to the payday industry, and they will admit that the average person takes 2 or 3 months to pay back one of these loans, and it's very typical that they're paying hundreds and hundreds of dollars in fees. And, you know, the kind of misery we're looking at right in this country since 2008, it's really good for these industries that the more people who are struggling on the margins, the more customers who are coming into their shops.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you, Gary, so much. It's a riveting book, Broke, From Pawn Shops to Poverty. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to Chrissy Pease for on-air production, and thanks, everybody, for your calls.